I'm so psyched to be at Usenix, and they let me in through the front door. I am Lars Lettinen, and I'm here sort of from opsangeles.com. That's my consultancy, but I'm one of the organizers of LA DevOps, and we have made it our mission to show up and be speaking at a lot more conferences this year and coming years. So hopefully this is but the first you've seen of someone from our meetup. And the screen's off because I'm from the school that believes that over-reliance on PowerPoint causes space shuttle disasters. So this talk is just us. If you need a visual aid, use the network that works this year and look up burnout on Wikipedia. Specifically, there's a disambiguation, burnout psychology. That article lists the 12 stages of burnout as identified by Herbert Freudenberger and Gail North. And paraphrased, in the interest of me not just barking out psych jargon up here, it goes like this. You have a need to prove yourself, so you work really hard. You ignore everything else in your life. Work becomes your native value system. You turn into a jerk. You use drugs or alcohol just to function or sleep at night in the service of doing more and better work. You develop an internal emptiness that cannot be filled. Your mental and physical health collapse, and then you kill yourself. The official name for step one of the Freudenberg and North stages of burnout is compulsion to prove oneself. An ops engineer with something to prove will work to the point of career collapse, brain damage, or worse. I've observed that a non-traditional career path is the norm for ops people. I asked a respected colleague how he got into this business, and his answer was that he got fired from his job at a muffler shop, so he got a job at CompUSA. He went from the muffler shop to CompUSA to an ISP support job to being a sysadmin to being a senior engineer at Cisco. A few steps in the middle. I think that everyone with some ambition in this field is going to overdo it at least once. And that's maybe okay the first time, because a compulsion to prove yourself is what gets you past job titles like LandTech 2. That desire to prove yourself is what gets you out of the first phase of your career, but it's going to get you stuck in the second. Tenacity and ambition become dysfunction. I don't have a degree in computer science, but I am a professional, but my path here wasn't through school. My parents divorced when I was really little. My dad lost his job. My family fell out of the middle class. I grew up eating federally subsidized school lunches, and once a month I'd wait in line with my mom at the park for our monthly allotment of powdered milk and government cheese. A particularly broken aspect of my broken family was that there was an expectation that I would help my mom raise my little brother, and I was included in financial decisions from way, way too young an age. I was raised to feel responsible for things that weren't my responsibility, and I brought this sense of responsibility into my adulthood to my detriment. The summer before my senior year in high school, my father announced that I was kicked out of the house come my 18th birthday in October, so I got a construction job over the summer as a roofer to save up money to finish high school and start my adult life. I moved into a friend's house to finish my senior year. I finished, I found a place to live, and I got a minimum wage job at a record store. After a year, I was promoted up to the main office. I grew up with computers, so without being asked, I made the computer the central part of my job because I was ambitious and it was an advantage that got me ahead. The inventory control system at work ran on a Xenix box, and I made dropping down to the shell to collect business data from the command line part of what I was getting paid to do. As a kid, I just wanted to somehow get into Unix work. It sounds quaint now, but remember, Linux didn't exist when I was in high school. Once it became usable in the early 90s, most people couldn't actually use it because most people couldn't actually afford a 386. But for me, being allowed to touch a Unix box, even a 286 running Xenix in 1994, was a heist. And at the time, well, I still felt like a loser because my friends had all gone off to college and I was working, full time. At the time, I didn't recognize that tenacity and ambition were the traits that got me from being a broke teenager to being an adult with a job. Sheer force of will. Our business is full of these stories. Muffler shop to CompUSA to ISP to dev job. I went from ice cream man to roofer to account executive to LandTech 2 to associate project manager to Linux support engineer to sysadmin to developer to director of infrastructure to senior product development engineer to my current gig as a consultant. It's the compulsion to prove yourself that gets you out of the crap job. I worked with a guy who grew up in a trailer in Oklahoma. He was a phone enthusiast. He committed to memory the important stuff in SS7. He moved to Boston. He convinced a SIP provider to just let him work there for free so that he could prove himself. And he did. He proved himself. And now he's in the business. In contrast, most of the business people who I've worked for grew up somewhere between upper middle class and rich. Now, emphatically, I need to state there's nothing wrong with growing up rich, happy, normal, all of the above. And I also concede that from the inside, a lot of families are a lot less rich, happy, and normal than they project to the outside world. But as someone who grew up without those advantages and had to chisel his way into a career by supporting himself on minimum wage at a record store, I carry a chip on my shoulder. The business people who conjure up ridiculous deadlines piss me off. They create synthetic crises, knowing that some up-and-comer will put in 80-hour weeks to prove himself worthy. The business people who understaff ops teams to protect their cash hoard or their equity stake anger me. The worst parts of my career have been spent servicing someone else's greed by being on call 24/7, responsible for maintaining an all-corners-cut infrastructure for people who got to take vacations and had the luxury of heading home at quitting time. I carry a chip on my shoulder. That resentment has fueled my ambition to keep pushing my career forward. The chip on my shoulder is pretty obvious to everyone around me, and that chip on my shoulder telegraphs low status. In my career, canny business people could see right through it, and they used that chip on my shoulder to manipulate me into working far longer hours than they did. When I've allowed myself to be mistreated, that chip on my shoulder has grown from a quirk to a seething contempt that destroys business relationships. In the moment, what feels constructive is to prove to all concerned that I can work harder and longer than anyone, that my judgment, if relied upon, can help get us around any difficulty and through any crisis. I linked my ambition with my resentments. I wanted to jam my smarts and my work ethic down people's throats. My bosses were happy to take the hard work, but weren't much interested in my judgment and experience. I thought meritocracies were real. I didn't understand the symbiosis between developers and business people, and I didn't understand that most of the time, ops doesn't have any place in that relationship, and I wound up very, very disappointed. Remember how good it was? How good this felt. You're 10 years old, you master something on your computer, now amazingly good it felt to project your will into the machine and actually have it made real. It happened. It did what you wanted. And it was a little hard. Most business people aren't particularly technical. They never get to experience that feeling until they have a developer working for them. They get to feel this experience for the first time only as adults and only through the proxy of a programmer standing over their shoulder. Instead of managing expectations, building relationships, or shepherding deals, they are, for the first time, interacting with science fact and non-subjective reality. And it's an intoxicating experience. They put aside reason. They're high on a sense of agency that they've never had before, and they binge on the creation of software features, which is great news for developers. But for us, I see an engineering team working like this. Developers give you features. QA goes looking for flaws in those features and gives you the courage to deploy, which means increased velocity, which means more chances to iterate. Ops, given the authority to do so, is going to provide a stable platform as well as the attendant monitoring and metrics to measure stability and availability. QA and ops have a complicated relationship with features because QA points out what's broken, what's unusable, and what destroys performance. And ops is the group most likely to point out the fragility or unmaintainability of a new feature. The business people want to hear about features. The business people want to hear about limitless possibility. They want to talk about up and to the right. They do not want to hear about limitations, caveats, and warnings of doom, all of which are our stock in trade. Our expertise is a buzzkill. Voicing our professional judgment is what gets us ignored. Pointing out the flaws in engineering prior to deployment is exactly what we're supposed to be doing. We're doing our jobs, and I've personally felt that righteous sense of integrity in pointing out exactly how some engineering decision is going to leave the team totally screwed, and I've been totally right. And this kind of assertiveness is entirely unwelcome. Sticking your elbows out and advocating for your agenda is a right reserved for business people, not for engineers. Worse, the chip on my shoulder negates my input. Business people can advocate for their agenda, from the CEO all the way down to the marketing assistant. And as a generalization, they're all going to advocate for a debased and broken implementation of Agile, which goes like this. Go as fast as you can, all day, every day. We're going to be over here changing our minds a lot. Developers crank out features, and debased Agile works for them because they can tie compensation and prestige to making business people's feature wishes come true. The even worse news here is that developers are incentivized to build their stuff, their features, using technologies that they don't understand. For example, a mediocre PHP programmer can be reborn as a Node.js rock star by making some blog posts and by the appearance of Node.js on their resume. When a technology is new enough, there is no one around sufficiently qualified to judge who's good and who's not. The transformation from crappy enterprise programmer to new hotness Node rock star is the stuff that 30K salary bumps are made out of. Why would you use Postgres to build something that works when you could use MongoDB? It might work. And now you have the word MongoDB on your resume. It isn't your problem if it breaks, that lands on ops. Now, developers aren't bad. This isn't about good and evil, right and wrong, or tribes. It's about incentives. Developers have a financial incentive to cobble together broken stuff, and you cannot fault people for wanting to get paid. Buzzword bingo pays really, really well. But operations winds up on the hook for tending to these failure-prone and experimental technologies. Operations is not awarded any points for having pointed out from the beginning that the unproven technology would get the project stuck or worse. Turns out we're not judged by uptime. We're judged by our willingness to put in brutal hours to mitigate technical problems, preventable or not. I have never seen an employee evaluation form that afforded any number of stars for the gift of prophecy. No one cares before or after the fact that a project is doomed. What matters is the appearance of progress. Business says uptime's important, and we do what we can to protect the nines. We report up the chain where the problems are, and we're often ignored, but we work hard to prove we've got it handled. And we're so awesome, someone should start listening. But no one's going to be impressed, because no one cares. Availability and reliability are not important to business. They count as nice-to-haves. I was working in a consulting engagement. We're doing a lot of work to move data out of a problematic NoSQL store into a traditional relational database. In order to run that migration, we need to down part of the application for 20 minutes. And now we're not going to touch the API that serves the mobile clients, that drives revenue and is the real business, but instead we're taking down a web interface that's used for onboarding new partners a couple times a week. I'll be charitable, a few times a week. The CEO is insistent this work had to be done at 10 o'clock at night so as not to affect the business. The whole engineering staff would have to be on standby, tuck your kids into bed, get ready to deal with whatever unforeseen problems might arise. The lead dev and I would have to be on site together. And I was game, but I pointed out that under the terms of our consulting agreement, having me around at 10 o'clock at night was going to add an extra $600 to my invoice for the day. Under the threat of $600 sanction, the CEO decided we should do the migration at 3 in the afternoon instead. There's an economic law at work here, and I'm going to repeat it twice. When the cost of a good becomes zero, demand becomes infinite. You remember that from, 10th grade, something like that? If the cost of a good becomes zero, demand becomes infinite. If the cost of working engineering staff day and night costs the same as days only, the demand for off-hours work will be without bound. To fix this, we need to change the incentives. When it costs money to keep me up all night, demand collapses to nothing. If we're to fix our lives, and if we're to fix this profession, we need to stop answering the phone after we're done with work for the day. If the essential parts of your stack need to go down in order to do a deploy, you built it wrong. I can observe my descent into burnout by looking back to my relationship with the users groups and my home lab. It used to be I visited several meetups a week, and I'd bring along my collection of vintage prime lenses. I'd take a bunch of pictures. Back at home, I had a 5-node object store running on the shelf next to my desk. I was not just buying, I was actually reading technical books. The home lab object store got downgraded, so I'd have a testing environment before doing an upgrade at work. And once it was down, it never came back up. And my cameras, I don't think I've touched in a couple years now. And as for my real-life hobbies, I was one of the organizers of Los Angeles Bike Summer in 2005. I spent a lot of time riding bikes, being parts of bike advocacy. That all went away. And it's only been this summer that I've swung my leg over a saddle again. In my career and in my life, things got terrible. Come last year, after a year and a half, I quit a job. Instead of accepting the futility of the endeavor at the beginning, I waited until I caught my boss flat out lying to me. There's a lot of stories about that job. In the end, they get very, very ranty. It was bad for all the reasons I've described and more. Tenacity and ambition are of no use in a situation like the one I was in. In fact, both of those qualities worked pretty strongly against me. I should have stopped and said, this project, from my vantage, is doomed. I'm leaving this place before we all hate each other. Hopefully, we'll get to work together again under better circumstances. But instead, I tried to tough it out, hoping that someone in management would eventually have to answer for our uninterrupted string of failures. Maybe some good manager could be found somewhere to lead us to some small measure of success. We had an opportunity to build something awesome. But my wished-for outcome did not come to pass, and things for the team only got worse. One guy defriended me on Twitter, and one of my friends on the team disconnected from me on LinkedIn, which I took to mean, Lars, please, never speak to me. Never speak to me ever again. And thus began a vicious cycle where no one was listening to me, so I worked harder, thinking hard work would earn some credibility, and someone would start listening. But no one was listening, so I worked harder, so I could earn some credibility, so I could get stuck in a really nasty loop. My ability to get anything done, of course, evaporated. They had us working from home, and I'd nap or procrastinate all day instead of doing any real work. Finally, at some point in the evening, I'd work up the will to fail, and I'd work on some dead-end project until the early hours of the morning. I'd skip bathing. I'd cross the street for fast food a couple times a day. Otherwise, I wouldn't leave my house for days at a time. I put on a lot of weight. After quitting that job in May of 2013, I scraped together some hope and took a new job, which I will refer to as summer job. Not roofing this time. There I discovered some new broken workplace character archetypes and again found myself in a completely unfixable situation. By July, I pulled the CTO and the new VP of engineering into a conference room and I told them, I don't have the authority to fix this situation. Let's part ways now before we all hate each other. Hopefully we'll get to work again together someday, somewhere under better circumstances. I can guarantee you it's not going to be here. It was only several years ago that I figured out an absolute truism, which in hindsight is so obvious that I hope it has a name. I got out of a bad summer job situation early using this lesson as the lever. Responsibility and authority are the exact same thing. If you have authority over something, you are responsible for its outcome. If you are responsible for something, you have the authority to make decisions for it. Authority and responsibility are inseparable. So if you're ever told that you're responsible for something over which you have no control and no authority, you will fail. Because no one ever passes responsibility without authority and expects the recipient to succeed. You're either being set up as a scapegoat or you're being guilted into putting in an effort beyond what is reasonable. Leaving summer job was the absolute right thing to do, and I still exchange email with some of the people I worked with, and none of us appear to hate each other. From experience, I can tell you that being the third person to leave is a lot better than riding a fiasco all the way to the bottom. Leaving a startup, it turns out, is the easiest thing in the world if you're not the founder or a C-level executive, because your equity is most likely meaningless. You've got no skin in the game. A few years ago, I consulted for a team that was so compelling, I shut down my consulting practice and signed up as a full-time employee, which was totally worth it. I learned a lot and worked with some great people. We were in the advertising space. A new CEO came in and he gave us the mandate to build an ad network. And we did. We cranked it out all summer and we met our deadline. We built it, we scaled it, and it was built strong enough we were able to make changes in flight and improve on it. We poured heart and soul into that project. Our lead drew a picture of a volcano on the engineering whiteboard with dollars gushing out the top, which he labeled the money fountain. One of the guys was regularly talking about all the cool stuff, the kit car he was going to build once we all got rich. We totally outgrew our office. Our DSL connection was down 15 minutes out of every hour. We were doing our deploys from the Wi-Fi at a coffee shop down the street, but we were all in it together. Beyond my responsibility to build the AWS infrastructure for our compressed timeline ad network project, I took on the project of readying a new office. I saw something that needed doing, and I felt like I was enough of a stakeholder, shareholder, that I should take on whatever I could in the absence of anyone else stepping up. The AWS work is what I was hired to do, and all the facilities stuff had nothing to do with my job description. So when the new CEO came in to make an org chart, he showed it to the whole company, and he stuck me in the dev team at the very, very bottom, and instead of breaking ops out into its own unit. So in practice, this meant whatever the devs wanted, the devs got, and all I could do was kind of cajole from the very, very bottom of the org chart, down below everybody. I wasn't angry, but I was frustrated. As a consultant, they hired me as an expert to come in and fix their broken infrastructure. I made stable that which had vexed their dev team. Their stuff was very broken, and I fixed it. There's no debate there. But I became an employee, and suddenly I was at the bottom of the chart. My involvement with the facilities management was ridiculous. I stuck myself in that position because I was convinced that the move would be a failure unless someone competent got involved. I saw it as an opportunity to earn some credibility. I was being driven by a compulsion to prove myself. I was an ops team of one, and I overdid it for months and months. Now, a lot of companies are going to tell you they only hire A players. Their strategy is to strip mine the job market of only the people who are already trained up without having to make any investment in developing the up-and-comers. We only hire A players also means you can't have a junior. The primary skill of a senior engineer is to be bringing up the junior engineers. So if your job title says senior and there's no juniors around, you're not a senior engineer. What is expected of you is to work as a 10x multiplier junior and get paid as a 1.5x multiplier junior. You're stuck performing all the junior tasks while taking care of all the senior stuff with no time left to move your skill set forward. Your future earning potential is being damaged more and more each month that you stick around working as a one-man band. I did manage to get my title fixed at that job, but I never got a junior engineer to work with. As an engineering team, we did fix the burnout problem by figuring out, as I kind of alluded, that our equity was not worth anything. When I started, I felt so fortunate to finally be on a high-functioning engineering team. I was determined to not be the weak link that prevented the rest of the team from experiencing a life-changing exit. I was showing the world that I deserved to be working with ex-Google engineers, and I could hold my own on a team with guys holding CS grad degrees. And we all knew we were depending on each other. I knew the tide turned the day the founder injected himself in an engineering meeting, and he piped into our planning by adding, well, what can we do to pick up the pace and bring an even greater sense of urgency? My response consisted mostly of obscenities, and I pointed out that Lead and I were already drinking ourselves to sleep every night to cope and wind down our brains from the stress. I scheduled a meeting with the CEO to figure out exactly what my equity looked like, other than the founder's pitch that our equity was really good. I learned that my options would take 4 years to vest, which is normal, and represented 0.05% of outstanding shares subject to dilution upon further rounds of funding. I love this part. So there's 100%, there's 50%, there's 10%, there's 1%, there's a tenth of a percent, and then half of that. 4 years from now. Maybe, if we don't take any more funding. Finding out I had nothing was awesome. I was liberated. I remember walking around the block and feeling like I got a shot at getting my life back. I remember thinking, all this for maybe a Toyota Corolla? I spoke with every engineer on that team individually, and I asked them to make an appointment with the CEO so they could learn the nature of their options. And it took a couple of weeks. But then every other engineer on that team knew what I knew, which is that we were employees who had been tricked into thinking we were something more. That was the moment where burnout turned around for all of us because we no longer felt that we were responsible for our teammates' financial future. We dusted off our resumes and started work to find new jobs. We wanted to stick together, but we were getting paid well under market. People had joined, especially the Google guys, had taken pay cuts to join this company. My only ask to my teammates was that no one put forth a salary ultimatum. Let our resumes hitting the wild be our message. And this is an important point. Threats destroy leverage. Never make an ultimatum. Ask for what you want. Know what your floor is. Don't push for a raise unless you're willing to hand over your resignation the moment they say no, with no turning back. Our well-timed simultaneous resume release was noticed, and without anything being said, we were called in for raises. To a man, we got the raises we asked for, on the spot, no counter-negotiation, 20 to 50% raises. Our strategy worked because it was scary, mysterious, and opaque to management. Had we individually made some kind of pay me $150K or I'm gone demands, it would have reduced the problem to math. Someone would have made a spreadsheet. Instead, it also would have meant that if they called us on our ultimatum, anyone who didn't follow through on their threat would have been forever marked as a pushover and as a lightweight. To succeed in negotiation, you need to be able to say no. If the opposing party knows you can't say no, and that's apparent, they're going to push you further than they ever imagined. You will have given away leverage, and you'll have made yourself weak, not only in this dealing, but in every subsequent one. I'm going to come back to the importance of no at the very end of this talk. I burned out last year. So burned out, I was worried that maybe I'd accumulated enough damage that I might need to leave the profession. The 3 month sabbatical that followed was a hard requirement. So I came to this. Know what you want. I know that when things for me have been terrible, all I've wanted to do is just stop going to work. I just wanted the frustration to end. After my sabbatical, and now back to consulting, I'm able to articulate what it is that I want. For example, recently, I'm signing up a new client. He casually drops the line, and I assume you'll be our on-call guy now as well. To which I responded, well, unfortunately, the nature of my business model precludes any kind of off-hours commitment. I've got multiple customers, so I can offer you an after-hours rate, which I keep high enough that I'm incentivized to answer the phone if it rings in the middle of the night, but it'll be subject to my availability. And there was no pushback. Maybe I could have gotten off-call a long time ago. Maybe I should have asked. The last time I got fired from a job was in 1996, and it was from a job that sucked. I'd already attempted to resign 2 or 3 times, and they always talked me into staying. I was so visibly disgusted with the situation that I did finally earn my termination. If you stay in a job that you desperately want to leave, you will eventually get fired. Even if you get out before they ask you to leave, your reputation will have suffered. People won't remember the good times. People will not remember your hard work. They will remember the burned out, cynical, angry, and ineffective version of you forever. You will not be working with any of those people ever again. Me, I need to keep doing this kind of work for 30 more years. Some of you only have 5 or 10 years left. There's probably somebody in the room that's got 50 years of this ahead of them. You'll be at Usenix 64. So here's a shortcut to wisdom that took me a while to acquire. Business people are as replaceable as lawnmower parts. There is a limitless and endless supply of them. They come to tech hubs from all over the world to make or lose their fortune. This has been true for 100 years. It's going to continue. These business people see you as a cost center to be automated or outsourced away. You are not likely to have a long-term relationship with any of them. Every time they embark on a new startup, they have to hire an entire tech team from scratch because everyone from the last team knows better than to ever work for them ever again. There is no value in proving yourself to a business person. Engineering, in contrast, is a small world. My relationships with my fellow engineers are going to determine my livelihood for the 30 years remaining in my career. Now, a bad manager will try to pit engineers against each other, imagining they'll rise to the occasion as would a sales team pit against itself for a prize. If you're working to prove yourself to anyone, it's not to your boss, it's the other engineers. Now, that said, not everyone can know everything, and worse, there are some technologies that just don't work. Yes, we all need to know how to code, but no, you don't need to apologize for not having a CS degree. Some developers are going to judge you by how much of a computer scientist you are, and I say you should politely push back against that, because computer scientists, freshly minted from university, are not trained and are not qualified to do what we do. Don't let them pretend they are. I made the case before that a lot of us wind up here because we're smart and driven people working to overcome the handicap of growing up poor or in a dysfunctional family. So if you ever hear a business person refer to the company as a family, you need not speak out, you need not say anything, even though you know just how much of a nightmare a family can be. But you do need to take an internal pause and remind yourself that you've seen just how badly this can all play out. And these people don't have your back. They're not motivated to see you succeed in life. They have no incentive to hope you're going to visit them in the nursing home. They pay you money so that you can make them more money. The end. That's the relationship. I promise to expand on the use of the word no. I've picked up a bit of showbiz advice. This is how you get the pay bump. This is how you leave on-call behind. Once you've figured out what it is that you want, this is how you get it. No is the password to the next level. My pay and my opportunities to work on cool projects with smart people has increased every time I've used it. No, I won't work for a company that stuffs spyware into a Linux distribution. No, I won't work with someone who yells at me. No, I'm not going to work for someone who bounces paychecks. No, I'm not going to spin my wheels building up a Timken village for an investor unwilling to cut his losses and admit failure. No, I'm not going to work day and night to keep up the fiction that this product does what you pretend it does. No, I'm not going to be responsible for fixing a relationship with a vendor over whom you have no leverage and is billing you more in a month, more than I make in a year. And now with a smile, and at the beginning of the relationship instead of at the end, I can say, no, my business model is such I can't be responsible for off-hours coverage. I have other customers. What I do have is an after-hours rate, which I keep high enough to provide me with an incentive to answer the phone if it rings in the middle of the night. So always be asking yourself, who am I trying to impress? And the answer should be, the engineers who I'm going to be working with for the rest of my career. Your intellect is a physical resource, and stress can ruin it forever. Your job is not your family. Please remember, the engineer sitting next to you at work is likely to be across the table making a hiring decision at some point during the 30 years left you've got in this work. Ours is a very small world, and no one's been hiring any juniors for the last 10 years, so it's only getting smaller, and it's only getting balder, grayer, and older. You have a lot more leverage than you think. We can fix our lives, and we can fix our profession if we stop working at night for free. You're an adult with a job. You're allowed to say no. I encourage you to start. Thank you. We've got some minutes, so if anyone wants to...
First, thank you. Just a suggestion that I've experienced in my work. I work for a university, and when one division has said, well, upgrades must happen at 10 p.m., 11 p.m., my manager's pushback was, fine, not a problem. You, as that division's management, needs to be on site at 10 p.m., and all of a sudden they're like, we can do it in the afternoon. So just a...
Funny how that works. Yeah.
Hi.
Hey.
Thanks for coming and talking to us today. I had a question. So you mentioned that about a year or so ago, you got to the point of being burned out. What did you do to kind of come back from that point and keep your interest in this profession alive?
Well, it was really scary because I had to accept that I couldn't keep working and that it was killing me. And that my intellect was crumbling underneath me, and that I couldn't pull up my pants and keep going, that I just had to accept that, well, that's what the savings account's for, this. And so I did nothing. I hung out at home. I watched all of Miami Vice except for the dumb amnesia episodes. I watched all of Star Trek Next Generation except for the Borg episodes and the body switching ones because those freaked me out. And I did a lot of reading, actually. I talk a big game about being an engineer and business people. Business actually is really kind of interesting to me. Like, that's always been sort of my favorite part of the newspaper because that's usually where the most actual facts are. And I like business case studies. So one of the things I did was read a couple... I'm really into ThinkPads, so I read a few books about the ThinkPad. One recent one about the X300 and how that was their, you know, great hope and how that went nowhere. But then also a history of the whole division from back in the 80s into the early 90s. And it was kind of heartbreaking because I saw how, like, these different people, there'd be these shortcomings in the company and they'd, like, you know, bring in a marketing expert and then, okay, now, like, we can't make enough of these, so fire him, bring in the manufacturing expert. Now, we, you know, it's just like, it's just all this bottleneck-driven stuff where people are just, like, getting tossed, IBM's just throwing people over its shoulder every time it runs into a new problem. And I was like, oh, well, I guess I'm not alone. I did get very interested in the, Baumeister, the stuff you keep seeing in the New York Times. It's like Malcolm Gladwell kind of stuff about willpower and, like, the kids, the studies of the kids with the marshmallow. You ever seen that one where it's like, you know, they do the double, they have the mirror behind them, and you take a bunch of, like, four-year-olds, and you put them in front of a marshmallow, and you say, all right, whoever doesn't eat the marshmallow gets four marshmallows in 20 minutes, you know, and they have a camera on them, and, like, you know, some of them just eat it right away, some of them pick it up and lick it and put it back down. The other ones just sit there like, oh, cool, four marshmallows in 20 minutes, awesome. And, I mean, that's not very interesting until you look at those people 20 years later, and the kids who could just sit there with their hands folded are doctors and lawyers, and the kids who couldn't are all in jail or dead. So... So there's been more and more studies about this stuff, and it turns out that decision-making and willpower are tied to blood sugar levels in your body, and it's depletable. And you can actually get people into a state where they're making bad decisions or not exerting willpower, and you give them a glass of lemonade, and they'll come right back. And, I mean, what is ops work if not making really important little tiny decisions all the time? And it's like, wow, what if, here's something I can go on. Like, something's obviously physically wrong with me, and maybe it's this. So I got really interested in ways I could even out my blood sugar level, and I got interested in high-fat, low-carb diets, and it's done wonders for me. I've lost a bunch of weight. I think that's probably hallway talk. But, I guess the answer I should have given you was I just had to be prepared to go broke and hope I didn't, and luckily I didn't.
Cool. Thank you.
It's a foot race.
So I wonder to what degree the problem is one of lack of self-confidence. 1926, Henry Ford chose to reduce his workers' hours to 40 a week and increase their pay, and he got far better performance out of them. Now, if someone who is working on very mechanical, routine work can have a performance benefit by doing that, then obviously mind workers like us would have a far better improvement from that. I don't understand quite why managers, why particularly your managers, did the death march thing. Can you imagine how it would have been if you just said, I will work 40 hours and you will get great performance out of me?
Sounds awesome. I heard it used to be like that in the before times.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, yeah. I mean, it. I mean, so now we're straying off into other stuff. But yeah, I mean, there was a time when the stuff that elites in this country said and what they did, they knew they'd say stuff they didn't actually believe, but, you know, they were advancing a purpose. You know, the stuff that came out of Prescott Bush's mouth was, I mean, that guy knew how the world worked, no matter what he said, right? And Bush won. You know, like, well, he might have said stuff about, you know, party line, this is what the Republican Party believes. The guy ran the CIA. He knew things, how things actually worked. But, you know, our last Bush, I think that guy believed all of it, you know? And, I mean, kudos to him, right? He's consistent. But, I mean, we live in a world where the apologies for all kinds of dumb stuff have gone from being fictions to actually being believed in. I think this is how religions start, but...
So I mean,
the wrong ones, of course.
I actually tried reducing my hours from 60 to 40. I didn't tell managers, I just did it. And it worked out very well for me. So I heartily endorse this as a plan. Yeah.
Well played.
First, I want to thank you for helping to clarify some things about my current situation where I'm trying to figure out how to articulate why I'm upset, why some things are annoying me. In particular, I've actually been saying for years that in outside of work context, that I will not take responsibility without authority. In this case, I'm involved in a lot of sort of arts organizations and running of community bands. And that's sort of the catchphrase I use when things come up. And it works. It's like, okay, well, I became like president of a community band once saying, okay, now I have the authority, now I can produce the concerts. I hadn't applied it to my work situation, because in work situation, you sort of think you're protected by large infrastructures. I've generally worked for very large companies. So I want to thank you for sort of clarifying, right, the things that work in that also work in the work situation. And the other thing, this is a comment, not a question. I mean, I'm a tech writer, but not an engineer or a system administrator. But the parallels here, when you're talking about buzzword bingos, and now I've been in this field for 30 years or so. And again, mostly large companies, and I've seen a lot of companies. I've been there at the time when they've been doing very, very well financially, and they start expanding. And what that often means is a whole new set sort of recurs from decade to decade of buzzwords that manifest themselves in broken agile implementations, in, oh, better customer service and better customer feedback. And so within your own department, you get rewarded for how well you play the buzzword games. Instead of doing, you know, say, actually documenting, you spend a lot of time on department initiatives and how you're going to address this and how you're going to fulfill the new department goals and buzzwords. Years and years and years ago, my big fight was the department said, well, man pages aren't important because we're doing and whatever the initiatives were. And meanwhile, I'm coming to USENIX conferences, I myself am using systems, and I kept saying, actually, people use man pages more than they use any other documentation we produce. So in response, I never felt ambitious. I would work on man pages, whatever they said, because that was important. To me, it felt like integrity, got to feel better about things, was not, you know, didn't get the raises, didn't get mentioned in all the department monthly
this
notices.
This room's pretty smart. Somebody said, I don't know who, but one of you guys ought to know, all the best engineering work gets done in outright defiance of management.
Well, and but
can anyone cite that for me?
That's right.
All right, well, internet will know.
But my happy ending here is it turns out, in my experience, that then when the companies inevitably retract and layoffs start to happen, and you feel very vulnerable because you're not part of the people who've been doing the initiatives and mm-hmm. getting the raises, you're not the ones who get laid off. at some level, at some very pragmatic level of the business people, as somebody said to me years and years and years after a series of layoffs when we were talking about it, and I said, I was always so worried. And she looked at me and said, she was way above me in the organization, you were never going to be laid off. We knew who was doing the work. So in defiance of what the department buzzwords are, you have to give up some things like the little pats on the head and the raises for playing that game. But my experience in the long run is that it really does work out, and the people you have worked with then recruit you for their companies in the next time. I don't know if this parallels the sorts of thing you're saying that has to do with burnout, but what today
maintain your relationship with engineers. Exactly. That sounds like a happy ending. I think we're allowed to go to happy hour now. Thank you so much.